You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning. It is April 19th, 2021. Welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Roger. Happy to be here this morning.
Yes, it is a sunny but kind of chilly day. I understand we might get some rain later today. But meanwhile, we have a pretty interesting show this morning. Our first guest is going to be author Bonnie Marcus, who's going to talk to us about her new book, Not Done Yet, How Women Over 50 Regain Their Confidence and Claim Workplace Power.
We're then going to talk with the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development, and we're going to be talking about tech company Scorpion, who is going to be opening an office in Utah, adding up to 1,000 new high-paying jobs in the state for the next 5 years.
We're going to end the hour talking with Recyclops founder and CEO Ryan Smith. Recyclops is a company that is a technology startup that is innovating customer-centric sustainability solutions.
This morning, author Bonnie Marcus joins us to talk about her new book that looks at this issue, Not Done Yet, How Women Over 50 Regain Their Confidence and Claim Workplace Power. I am reading the completely wrong thing right now.
Employees can experience age discrimination in the workplace, whether they are young or of a more experienced age. The Age Discrimination in Employment Act was passed in 1967 and was designed to protect individuals 40 years of age or older from age discrimination in the workplace. But let's face it, it can be difficult to determine whether an employee's action was motivated by age discrimination or by a genuine belief that another person can perform a particular job better.
Our guest today wrote, "Research shows that as men age, they are viewed more valuable and competent in the workplace. Women lose their credibility with every new wrinkle. Based on earlier research, they say physical appearance matters more for women, since age detracts more from physical appearance for women than men."
Author Bonnie Marcus joins us this morning to talk about her new book that looks at this issue, Not Done Yet. Good morning, Ms. Marcus, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's start with the big picture. Talk to us a little bit about the presence of women over 50 in the workplace today. How substantial is it, and what are the challenges they're facing?
Well, as women show visible signs of aging, as you just indicated, we are seen as less valuable and less competent. So as women approach 50 and beyond, they find that they are marginalized, often not included in key meetings anymore. Their opinions aren't sought after anymore, and their workload is redistributed. And that's dangerous, because once you have less work that you're responsible for, it's much easier to push you out the door. So many of the women that I interviewed for this book were really subjected to terrible, demeaning remarks about being over the hill and being a dinosaur. And there was very little that they felt that they could do about it. They didn't have a safe platform to file a complaint. And they didn't want to bring more attention to the fact that they were aging.
So I know and want to acknowledge that how people feel is how they feel. And that, you know, when someone is feeling this is really truly what's happening. However, are there statistics that show that the number of women in the workforce over 50 has declined because of these attitudes, or that they're not holding as high a jobs? Bonnie?
Bonnie?
We lost Bonnie. There she is. Bonnie, I apologize. There you go. How far into the question were we?
I only heard the first word.
Uh-oh. All right, so let's go again. I want to acknowledge that when people are feeling that they're being discounted, or that, you know, their work is being taken from them or reassigned, that's how they feel and that's what's happening. But are there statistics that show that there are less women in the workplace over 50, or that they hold less senior roles?
Well, women definitely hold less senior roles. You know, we have been looking at gender equality for years and showing that women are not advancing at the same rate. If you look at the number of female CEOs in Fortune 500 companies, you know, it's a small fraction of what the positions that men hold. So there are certainly a lot less women, and the pandemic hasn't helped, right? So many hundreds and thousands of women have lost their jobs, and those women over 50 are finding it much more challenging to find new positions.
You know, Bonnie, quite often, describing situations like this are useful with sort of anecdotes. Can you mentioned that you talked to a number of women. Give us a sense of, you know, a little more specifics about the kinds of what I would call shunting that you see women over 50 being subjected to.
Well, I'll give you an example of a woman that I was coaching a number of years ago, which is actually the reason why I got so involved in this issue to begin with. She was a 58-year-old female attorney who was working in the legal department for a Silicon Valley company, a large tech company here in California. And she had always been a valuable contributor and a leader on the team, but now at 58, she was the oldest. And all of a sudden, things started to change. There were key meetings with clients that she was no longer invited to. Nobody sought, you know, asked her opinion about things. And as I indicated earlier, her workload was redistributed. And she knew instinctively that if she didn't have a full portfolio, it would be much easier to push her out the door. So I was coaching her through that really painful experience where, and again, it's not, all these experiences weren't necessarily so overt where somebody would come up and say, oh, you're too old. But in that case, it was pretty subtle, but she knew what was going on. Another interview, woman that I interviewed for the book, was working for a large retailer. And she was 50 some odd years old, and her children were off in college, and she wanted a new career. She was really excited about joining this organization, and she wanted to get into management. And repeatedly she was told, no, you can't, you know, we don't have a position for you. And then one day her manager took her down into the basement of this store, and her manager was like 30 years old. She sat her down on a wooden pallet and she said, look, you are just too old for this job. You don't have the energy. You don't have the stamina for it. And so that ended up being a lawsuit. That was really overt.
I would agree. That seemed pretty clear cut. And reading through some of your information, you know, I had found that, you know, a large sample of American adults show that ambition begins to increase at 55. Why is there a fear of women over 50, even more so over men over 50?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure it's a fear as much as it is the bias that they no longer have value. And in many cases, companies would like to push some of the older women out who potentially have larger salaries. But there is this belief that, you know, the workplace practices really mimic what society believes. And society believes that as you age, you have less value and you're no longer competent. You don't have the stamina, et cetera. So I'm not sure it's a fear of older women as much as it is a bias against them.
And, I take it you do a fair amount of coaching. Talk to us a little bit about the kinds of techniques that women, as they, you know, get into their 50s, should be employing to deal with this kind of bias.
Well, the first thing I think is so important is to do some self-reflection and to understand some of the limiting beliefs and stereotypes and fears that we have internalized. And, you know, when I started writing this book, I realized that I hold a lot of ageist beliefs. You know, when somebody says, oh, Bonnie, you look young for your age, I would like take that as a compliment. And now I realize that's kind of ageist, you know. But I think the danger here is that when we internalize some of these ageist beliefs, they end up holding us back and sabotaging us, and we don't realize it. So, for instance, if we really believe that we're too old to ask for a raise or we're too old to get promoted, then we're going to withdraw. We're not necessarily going to do the types of things that we would need to do for that to happen. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that's the first place to really start. And I will often have my clients tell me what their current story is. What's the story that you're telling yourself about yourself right now? And that's usually an eye-opener. And if you're really truthful about that and doing some deep work, you can then look at that story and say, does that story serve me or does that sabotage me? And very often these beliefs really do hold us back.
So you're talking about, you know, our internal stories that we tell each other. But a lot of ageism isn't necessarily what's going on in our heads. It's those outside. So once someone fortifies or kind of works through that exercise of understanding how they themselves are perceiving the situation, you know, what are those next steps that person could do?
Well, I think the first is the awareness that this is going on around you, right? And giving yourself the permission to address it when you are experiencing it. So similar to before the Me Too movement and when women were experiencing sexual harassment or abuse, they were afraid to speak up, to file a complaint. And so they were silent and they didn't have any kind of legal platform, right, where they felt that they could voice their experience. And I think that now, as women are aging in the workplace and subjected to gendered ageism, they feel much the same way, where they don't want to draw attention to themselves. They don't have a safe environment to talk about this. And so they actually just kind of stay in the shadows. So when somebody makes some kind of an ageist comment to you, and I talk about this in the book, I think that, first of all, you need to figure out who that's coming from and what is your relationship and was that said in jest, et cetera. But it's important to bring awareness to the issue and let people know how that particular comment or that behavior made you feel. If there's a repeated pattern, then I think you need to start documenting and you need to perhaps go to your HR manager and start talking about this and get this on the record.
Let's talk about it a minute from the employer perspective in the following sense. Obviously, HR practices vary widely across companies, from even among large companies. Talk to us a little bit about HR functions that you have seen that have been effective in addressing this issue, if any. Are there any companies you can point to that you think are doing a good job, and how did they do it? That doesn't sound like there are very many.
Let me count the ways. Gendered ageism and ageism are not being addressed in the workplace, and they need to be. So we have all these, DEI initiatives, doesn't include ageism. Very often companies, it's totally under the radar. So if it's not important to the company, it's not going to be important to HR, because obviously their customer, their client, is the company. So there's very little that is done.
And what about litigation? Have we seen effective or significant litigation results? Because, you know, as an aging lawyer myself, one of the things that I've learned is that companies tend to react and change behavior when they see other companies getting smacked big time by lawsuits. Have there been any sort of significant lawsuits or litigation progress with respect to this kind of an issue that it might have an influence on companies?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So, you know, we've talked about, or you've talked about HR, and I think one of the things that I'm familiar with since I've started my career is sexual harassment training. And I actually just went through some for my role here at the radio station. And, you know, one of the things that came up that was, you know, they showed examples of conversation situations and meetings and what would you do in this. But they really talk about it's how it's the responsibility of everyone, you know, to make sure that everyone's comfortable in the workplace. And so with regards to ageism, you know, what are some things that we can do to help bring awareness to this topic and help change the thinking?
Well, I think it needs to be included in similar programs to what you just went through, right? A similar program around ageism should be included in unconscious bias, because ageism is so ingrained in our society that we are totally unaware of the impact of it. I mean, you go and buy a birthday card for anyone, really, but especially an older woman, and it's like, oh, you know, give her a glass of wine and, you know, so she can find her keys. And, you know, we look at this and it's kind of like a joke, but really it reflects the bias, you know, in our society. And so I think the unconscious bias training will help bring more awareness to that. I think that leaders in companies need to go through these programs and also take an assessment of what kind of ageist beliefs that they may hold. And how does their company, how do the workplace practices and policies, do they reflect these kinds of biases?
So that's interesting. I guess workplace training now generally does not have, I mean, is what you're saying is that,
no,
that workplace training does not have an ageism component to it. And as I think back to the ones I've attended, I don't remember an ageism segment.
No, no. And I was just speaking to somebody last week who is a gender equity expert, Jeffrey Halter. And he said that, you know, he's in companies all the time doing programs around gender bias. And he said there's nothing on ageism. Companies aren't paying attention to it at all. And therefore, certainly not gendered ageism.
That's the question. I guess a good question is, does the training need to be aligned with gender versus just ageism in general?
I think it starts with ageism in general, but the gender component needs to be stressed, simply because women are, you know, face it much earlier than men.
And from my understanding as well, you know, we've talked a little bit and as far as laws, and we've referenced sexual harassment, but there are laws against ageism. And from my understanding, that starts when someone hits 40.
True, but it's a very weak law, and it's so easy for companies to get around it. You need to show patterns of repeated behavior. You need to prove that it's not bullying and it's, in fact, age-related. It's just very difficult to do. Now, in the case of the woman that I spoke of a couple of minutes ago, where the manager came out and said, "You're too old," well, you know, that's a little easier to prove. But on the other hand, a lot of this is difficult to say, okay, I was let go because of my age. Companies will say, we're downsizing, you know, we're reorganizing, and they'll put a number of different spins on it and get away with it.
So, again, I'm not familiar with the precise legal structure, but are you telling us that the protections surrounding age discrimination are significantly weaker than those surrounding other workplace discriminations? I mean, is that why it's so much harder?
Yes.
So, you know, looking at the type of information that you've been sharing with us and some of those tips, how can your advice help younger women?
They need to be proactive. You know, the advice that I give in the book for women to stay marketable and keep their jobs, that advice is advice that anybody should follow their whole career. What I'm stressing is that now as you're approaching 40, 45, 50, you need to be even more vigilant about being visible, right? About building a strategic network, about declaring your ambition and cultivating your growth mindset and being curious and staying up on your skills. Because I think there's a belief, a misconception, that if we've got this great track record and we've been doing good work for a long period of time, that work, that great performance is going to carry us through retirement. And that's not necessarily the case. So the message is to be aware and to be proactive and stay vigilant.
That sounds like great advice for anyone at any age. We've been speaking with Bonnie Marcus. She's the author of Not Done Yet, How Women Over 50 Regain Their Confidence and Claim Workplace Power. Bonnie, thank you for joining us today on Mountain Money. Last month, the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development, otherwise known as GOED, announced tech company Scorpion will open an office in Utah, adding up to over 1,000 new high-paying jobs in the state for the next 5 years. Joining us to talk about the efforts that take place to draw Scorpion and other companies to Utah is Dan Hemmer, Executive Director of GOED. Dan, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, can you take a moment and perhaps just start off by, you know, talk to us a little bit about GOED and how the efforts at GOED really brought Scorpion to Utah? What was provided and how did the discussion begin with them?
So as far as how exactly the discussion began, I wasn't here, so I'm relatively new, transition appointment that coincided with the Cox administration taking over in early January. So I wasn't here when the conversations initially started with Scorpion, but I can speak in general how conversations start with companies who are looking to either move to Utah or Utah companies looking to expand within Utah. And it's really simple. They just pick up the phone and give our office a call. And once that happens, we will just have a conversation with them. We'll talk to them about the parameters of the incentive programs we have and see whether or not they fit. And if they do fit and they deliver a specified number of high-paying jobs, and we define high-paying jobs as jobs where the average salary is over 110% of the county in which the company is looking to either expand or relocate to, and then they have to make a certain amount of capital investments, like build a building or bring equipment, and if they meet that criteria, then we can give a portion of the new state income tax, sales tax, that they pay into the state, we can give a small percentage of that back to the company after they've paid it into the state.
So give us a sense of the size of the operation of GOED. How many employees do you have? How many companies do you deal with a year? Just give us a sense of the operation a little bit.
Yeah, and so GOED actually has 85 employees. It's part of the governor's office. And we specialize in economic development, as the name would imply. That said, the corporate incentives piece of GOED is probably less. There's there are three people, so three out of 85. So the governor's Office of Economic Development does a lot more than corporate incentives. That said, corporate incentives are what we're most known for, probably because it's the easiest for us to issue a press release around the corporate incentives. A lot of the other work we do around tourism marketing, around rural Utah economic development are harder to capture in a quick little press release. So the incentives team is only about four people, three or four people, and while the rest of GOED is about 85 people.
We're going to ask you more about the other 83, but I want to stick with the three for a few minutes. The sort of corporate incentives team, how many companies a year are actually ending up qualifying for these incentives? And has that changed in the last, I know you probably have a sense of history, even though you weren't there. How has that changed in the last 5 to 10 years?
So it's stayed pretty steady the last few years. It's usually around 20 companies a year are awarded a corporate incentive. Now, a lot more companies inquire about incentives, but they don't qualify. And there's, you know, like anything, you can look at it as a funnel, right, where a lot request, not that many are either willing to do the work. It's not easy to qualify. There's a lot of legwork involved. And then also they have to qualify, which is also can be a higher hurdle because, like I said, we're only trying to incentivize high-paying jobs because the way we look at it, we're trying to drive the economy in an upward momentum. And it's the high-paying jobs in tradable industries, so jobs where you can export either the knowledge that these companies are creating, a product or service that really drives the local service sector, the non-tradable sector. And so we're trying to incentivize those high-paying tradable jobs in the tradable sector or the innovation sector, and by so doing, you know, the concept of a rising tide lifts all boats, and that helps helps improve the economic outlook for all the little companies as well.
So how long do these negotiations typically take with these companies, and can you give us a sense, perhaps in the dollar amount or the projected amount that Utah is going to see versus how much that corporation receives?
Oh, yeah, totally. So going back to, we typically do about 20 companies a year qualify for and receive the incentive. The average size of award is usually around $5 million, and this is also not well understood. If you receive an award for $5 million, we typically give back around 20% of what you pay in, and this is new state revenue. So to put that in context, if you get a $5 million award, you're going to typically get it over 5 to 10 years, meaning each year you have to qualify again, and we go through a pretty robust audit process to make sure there's new state tax revenue, and then we give a portion of that back. So if you got $5 million over 10 years, that means you would have paid into the state $25 million. So you give me 25 bucks, I give you five back. And that's how our incentive works. And so going back to projections, so we typically do around 20 a year, and that's pretty steady. Even during the pandemic, the average award size is typically around $5 million, meaning you have paid in $25 million in additional new state tax dollars. And what that means over the last 2 years, we awarded, again, around $5 million per company. We did about 40 companies. But those new companies, over those 2 years, they paid in $796 million in new state revenue, and they did over almost $13 billion in wages. And so what we're giving back is a pretty small percentage of what those companies are doing as far as new jobs and new state tax revenue.
Let's talk a little bit. Scorpion, I know, is a tech company. Let's talk a little bit about sort of the range of the types of companies that you're able to attract through this program. I mean, given that we're talking about high wages, and I believe you said it was 110%, is that 110% of average or median? Tell us a little bit
average
about
average for so it's average wage for the county mm-hmm. in which you're looking to locate.
Okay.
So Salt Lake County has a higher average than say Kane County.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that, and then Scorpion specifically, yeah. So they are a tech company, but they're really a marketing company. So they're a tech-enabled service company, you could call it, or a software-enabled service company. They do marketing for home services. So like a plumber. you're a local plumber, you can contract with Scorpion. They'll do all your marketing online primarily, digital marketing primarily, to bring you leads back to get you into more homes.
Again, let's talk a little bit about the broader question, though. 20 companies a year. Give us sort of a rough kind of breakdown of the kinds of companies that are coming to Utah now through these under this program.
Well, so one other slight misperception is that these are all companies coming to Utah. Only about 40% of EdTIF recipients are relocations. 60% of EdTIF recipients are Utah companies that are just expanding. So if you're a company expanding and you meet those thresholds, again, you're doing a significant capital investment, you have wages above 100% of the average, you can also qualify for a tax incentive if you're expanding here and if you were looking to relocate to a different state. So keeping companies in Utah is actually a bigger part of the program than recruiting companies. That said, what types of companies? So we're targeting high-tech companies. So think of it, the simple way to think of it is innovation sector type companies. So these are life science companies. These are software companies. These can be, you know, financial services companies. Companies that provide that are in the innovation sector or tradable sector where they can provide or create, they create a product or service that can be exported or is exportable.
I've got like five questions in my brain. I'm trying to narrow them down. I think, you know, one thing that I wanted to just understand a little bit farther is, as you said, 40% of the incentives that you give are for relocation, 60% are to keep companies in Utah. But if we start to look at what your criteria is with regards to the percentage of the, I believe it was average median income for the county that they're locating in, like, are we growing jobs in an area that needs growth? Do we need those high-paying jobs? And is that benefiting Utah as well as the, you know, the additional income if they stayed in Utah? Or I guess, what are the goals here?
So the goals are always to, so what we are trying to attract, again, those higher paying jobs, whether it's from an in-state company that's looking to expand, and one of the criteria is they have to be looking to relocate out of state. So that's, we're going to, hey, why don't you expand in Utah rather than opening up a satellite office in Colorado? And yes, we do think that keeping those jobs does have a multiplier effect across the entire economy. And let me give you one quick example. This is a study done in the Bay Area that for every single innovation sector job, so think of a software developer in the Bay Area, for every single one of those jobs that was created, they saw a multiplier effect of five local service non-tradable jobs. So those, and of those five, two were professional, so think a doctor and a lawyer, and then three were non-professional, so think a waiter, a dry cleaner. Well, let's just say two waiters because I'm not that creative. But so there is a multiplier effect with these higher wage jobs, because if you think about it, it makes sense, right? Someone needs to be making enough money to support that local restaurant, to support that local lawyer, that local doctor. And so those high paying jobs do have a significant multiplier effect on the broader economy, because the vast majority of people are actually not employed in those high paying jobs, right? They're employed in the local businesses, the local small businesses. I think it's over 60% of our workers in Utah are employed in local small businesses. But you need to have those higher paying jobs to support those local small businesses.
Utah is an incredibly attractive business environment. We have a lot of things going for us. But obviously, when we talk about someone who's thinking about moving out of state, we're in competition with other states for the siting of high-tech and high-paying businesses. Talk to us a little bit about where our incentive program fits relative to our competition. Are we sort of similar in terms of the kinds of incentives we offer, or is our competitive advantage such that we don't have to be quite as generous, if you will?
Yeah, so from a financial perspective, we actually have a not very rich incentive. other states have a, they'll just write you a check, right? We never write you a check. You have to earn it, meaning you have to, again, going back to my example, you have to give me $25 before I'm going to give you five back. You have to pay me first. And so it's not a very rich incentive. But what Utah has and has historically, and then we hope will continue to have, but some there's some headwinds here, which we can talk about if you want. But Utah's had a lower cost of living relative to other areas. So relative to California in particular, much lower cost of living. We have a highly educated, highly engaged workforce. And so that's the unique thing. And then the other thing we have in Utah that's unique, and this is a geographic uniqueness, there's no other major metropolitan area except maybe Seattle that has the proximity to outdoor recreation that we have here in Utah. So quality of life. Now we have we are seeing headwinds with the housing affordability issue, right? And you're all familiar with this. There's a shortage of housing units, and that's not just Utah. That is nationwide, but we're definitely feeling it here. And then also, our super low unemployment rate is becoming an issue. You know, we met with a company that has a big facility up in Cache County just last week, and they're actually looking to not expand in Utah. They're a life sciences company because the unemployment rate's so low, they can't find workers. And so we think our challenge for the future is not more jobs. It is actually figuring out how better to broaden the worker pipeline so that companies can continue to grow and succeed here.
So does that start to move us into the other 83 jobs that GOAB has, or the employees that you have? You had talked about GOAB having, you know, this one side of what they worked on, but is growing that employee pipeline part of your charge as well?
Yes, and so workforce development, and, you know, this is done in partnership with Division of Workforce Services and particularly our tech colleges or community colleges. We have a program called Talent Ready Utah. We have another one called Learn and Work, where we develop with companies training programs to create I don't want to say create, that sounds too impersonal, but to train individuals with a specific skill set to get jobs back in those companies. This very same company I was referring to up in Cache County, they have a partnership with Bridgeland Tech College, where it's a specific training program to develop a specific skill set for their facility. And so yes, that's also a go, and that's another big thing that we do here.
How has the pandemic affected Utah as Utah's attractiveness for the siting of industries? Do you think there's a significant long-term effect from, you know, the sort of fleeing of other large major urban areas that will have a positive effect on the location of business here?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we're seeing the most of those companies, it looks like, are actually, you know, if you know, flying over Utah, you know, we do have companies looking here. In fact, every week we're talking to companies from the Bay Area who are looking to relocate or to open satellite offices. And Utah's frequently one they look at. That said, and you've probably seen this, you know, a lot of them are going to Texas. You know, Austin's really, really hot right now. Georgia also. You're seeing Colorado, Nevada receive a bunch. But yes, we absolutely are seeing a number of companies that are looking to primarily California, leave California, and Utah is an area where they're frequent looking at. I mean, we just have a lot of great, you know, quality of life attributes. We got an international airport. We got this great crossroads of interstates. You know, we always say crossroads of the West. It's true. And with the it's not new, but it's really blossomed. Remote working and video conferencing, video meetings. You've seen a more general willingness, I think, for companies to look outside of California.
Well, I guess let's talk about again, a few of the other. We've mentioned sort of workforce development as another function of GOAB. What else do you guys do?
So we have a couple business services, and they're kind of technical assistance programs. And we think this is also something that's a big deal. So big companies don't need this. They got lawyers, they got professionals, and they got consultants. But the smaller businesses, we have a couple programs. One's called Procurement Technical Assistance Center. I know it's a mouthful. In essence, though, what it does is we have eight people throughout the state who work with small businesses who want to get into either federal government contracting or state government contracting. And what they'll do is they will hold your hand as a business owner or business operator through the procurement process. And it's a super, it's probably our most effective program that no one's ever heard of, unless you happen to be working with PTAC. But like I said, we have 8 people across the state of Utah, so they're located locally. And they will, if you call them up and you want to get into government contracting, they will help you navigate a very bureaucratic process, particularly federally. State, it's pretty simple, but they'll help you with the state too. So that's one. Another one is a matching program. Again, it's a technical assistance program to get federal grants for startups, particularly what are called deep tech industry ideas that you want to commercialize. So you want to take a concept to a business or to a product. And you can get grants through the federal program. It's the SBIR, Small Business Innovation and Research Grant. And we have 2 people who, what they'll do is, again, they'll hold your hand if you want to go through this grant process. And if you qualify, they'll hold your hand through that process to help you get a grant from the federal government that's an innovation grant or a startup grant. So that's another big piece. Also, because of the complication of these incentive programs, there's a big compliance. Like I said, there's an annual audit process that goes with these. And so we have a number of people who, you know, for good or for bad, are kind of our compliance team. So they will, if you did receive like an EDTIF incentive, an economic development tax increment financing incentive. If you did receive one, you have to go through an annual audit process. And these folks will make sure that you are still compliant in that you do actually qualify to receive those $5 we talked about earlier after you've paid in your 25. And they confirm that you did, in fact, pay in your 25 before you get the 5 back. We also have a big rural economic development center. And that organization works with rural communities to help them get ready from an infrastructure perspective. We have some grants to help them build like shared workspace innovation centers in their rural communities, and to help them figure out how can their local companies sell goods or services out of their local community. So how can they start growing those local companies in a bigger way? So that's another big thing. Another large aspect, a large team here at the Governor's Office of Economic Development is tourism marketing. So some of this is federal dollars, some of this is state dollars. Every time you stay in a hotel in Utah, a portion of those taxes goes back into a tourism marketing fund, where we market the state of Utah from a tourism perspective all over the world. We view this as something like a tradable good. It's like an exportable good, given that you come here, you spend money here, and then you leave, and your money, your dollars, about 70% of the dollars you spend locally stay locally. And in Park City in particular, as you may know, that is a huge driver of that economy, with the ski resorts and with your particularly out-of-state visitors who come, spend some time there, spend some money there, and then leave again. And that's another very large part of the GOED operation. Then we also have the Film Commission here. So this is a group that works with local film producers and film production companies to incentivize and motivate out-of-state film companies to film movies here. You know, we're all familiar with some of the movies that have been filmed here, like Galaxy Quest. You know, that was in Goblin Valley, in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Johnny Depp was in Hell, and there was a boat, and that was out on the Salt Flats. The Salt Flats apparently are hell or purgatory for pirates. Yellowstone with Kevin Costner, that was filmed here the first few seasons. That film has now moved to Montana. We're trying to get it back, but there are always films going on, and so that's another economic development driver, particularly off Wasatch Front, for these communities where a team will come in, they'll spend quite a bit of money in the local community, and then they'll leave. And those dollars, about 70% of those dollars, stay in that local community. And so that's kind of and then the last thing, sorry, this isn't the last thing, but it's the last thing on my mind. We also do all of the diplomacy and trade. So out of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. So we will set up trade missions, both domestic, so through the country, and then international, where Utah companies can go, for example, in October, we'll be going to Mexico. We'll be taking a bunch of Utah companies down to Mexico, where they can look at either supply opportunities with Mexican factories or selling opportunities to Mexican companies. and we'll go down there and host and facilitate a trade mission. And so that's another thing we do here at the Governor's Office of Economic Development.
You touched on a subject that's close to my heart in terms of, you know, local stuff, and that was Yellowstone. Yellowstone maintained that, as I understand it, that Montana offered substantially richer sort of incentives. As a general matter, are we looking at whether Utah is doing what it needs to do to attract, you know, local filmmaking, and are you thinking about any changes?
So this last legislative session, so our incentive is a good incentive. It's just that it's capped. So we can only spend so much per year, which, you know, that's a policy question, and whether that's good or bad, that's something else. Montana doesn't have those constraints, so yeah, they can do a much more generous award. Our program is sufficient, but it's capped how many dollars we can give out each year, so the program ran out of money. So the program itself perhaps doesn't need to be changed, but we are, I know the industry, at least the film industry here in Utah, is trying to mobilize and work hard to get that cap raised. So there's the ability to continue to do more. That said, last legislative session, I think the cap was increased, or there wasn't awarded another $1.6 million, I believe. But that's kind of the constraint we have, is we can only award a certain amount each year.
You've definitely given us a good breadth of information with regards to the Governor's Office of Economic Development. We've been speaking with Dan Hemmert. He is the Executive Director of GOED.
In the United States, 34 million homes and another 16 million apartment units lack access to convenient, affordable recycling. Recyclops' mission is to bring easy recycling to these homes through a peer-to-peer model and technology that allows the company to easily expand to even the most remote locations. Recyclops is a technology startup that is innovating customer-centric sustainability solutions. Recyclops leverages technology in local communities to bring recycling to communities that would normally not have access to it. Joining us this morning is the founder and CEO of Recyclops, Ryan Smith. Good morning, Ryan, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
So, you know, when I first start looking at the name, I have this vision of a large one-eyed monster. Tell us what Recyclops really is and how long it's been in operation.
So we are a sustainability company that specializes in recycling and in bringing recycling to where it's not. We've been in operation for 7 years, and yeah, that's who we are.
So when you say bring it to where it's not, give us an example of what the kind of place that would be and what you would do for it.
Yeah, so there's kind of two instances where we operate in that kind of bring recycling where it's not sphere. One is looking at communities that don't have recycling programs. So in the United States, there are approximately 50 million households that don't have access to recycling pickup. And you know, that some of those are, a lot of those are single family homes kind of off the beaten path, a little, you know, that aren't, you know, aren't in the urban centers. And then the other is apartments. And then the other area that we operate is, you know, specialized materials, materials that aren't accepted in normal residential recycling programs. And we'll launch programs for those materials. Like, for example, we do glass recycling in Nashville, Tennessee, because they don't have glass collection in Nashville.
So you do have operations in Summit and Wasatch County. What kind of services do you provide to this area?
Yeah, so in Wasatch County, we do residential recycling pickup for, you know, your standard paper, plastic, cardboard, metal. We also do glass recycling pickup in Wasatch. And then in Summit County, because the county already has a residential recycling program, we're focused mostly on the commercial. And a lot of that is still residential dwellings. They're just in, you know, condos and kind of multi-dwelling units. So we do a lot of businesses both throughout Wasatch and Summit counties, and in Wasatch specifically, we do, you know, a ton of residential homes.
So in a location that does not have a municipal sponsored recycling operation, what you provide a service, is it something that people voluntarily sign up for, and what kind of price point are you hitting?
Yeah, so it is something that people voluntarily sign up for. You know, most recycling programs, well, all recycling programs in the country are paid for by, in the end, by the people who use it. It's either paid for in tax dollars or it's paid for as part of a utility. In our case, it's paid for, you know, not through the city. It's not filtering through the city. It's a direct consumer. And so you subscribe for the service with us. In Wasatch County for a residential home, the starting point is $17 a month. And, yeah.
Are you offering, one of the big issues I hear about recycling here in Summit County is the inability to recycle glass. Are you offering that as an auxiliary service here in Summit, or are you just strictly doing commercial?
No, so we right now we are not doing any sort of auxiliary, you know, additional glass service. It is something that we've dug into, and I would expect at some point, you know, we would like to do that. In fact, you know, they're doing a bid for the newest, for the new recycling, you know, program for the entire county. And in Summit County, and we're going to be bidding on that. And one of the, you know, offerings that we want to really get into is the glass side. And that's, in a lot of ways, that's enabled by Momentum Recycling, who's out of Salt Lake, who has a glass facility. And they do a lot of, you know, glass collection as well, all over the place. So.
And I think that's an interesting piece that you mentioned about Momentum, because I know here in Summit County, there's always been a lot of discussion, and even many years ago, Recycle Utah looked at what is the cost of recycling glass and how much is it to move it to a processing center in order for it to be reused, and how much energy, where Momentum's changed that dialogue. In the communities that you're looking at, in the Nashville example, for instance, where you said that you were able to come in and bring a new material or be able to recycle a new material, how much is that kind of breaking down that hurdle of finding a local source that uses the material?
Yes, you know, generally speaking, there are companies out there that accept these materials and recycle them and get them back into a world where they're used in manufacturing. And in Utah, we're super lucky that we have Momentum here that enables glass. I mean, we offer glass recycling, and we operate in communities all throughout the state of Utah, you know, from as far south as Kanab and Cedar City and, you know, far east to Vernal. I mean, we kind of cover the state pretty well, in smaller communities. And we offer glass in all those communities. So most of these communities actually have better, you know, at least more accepting recycling programs than the big cities. Hmm. And, you know, but it does come with a cost. And so we charge, you know, depending on the area, it can vary a little bit. And Wasatch County, it's $8 additional to add glass to your subscription. So it, you know, it doesn't come for free, but that's the kind of cost you need to, in order to safely transport and get that recycling and to a recycler where they can actually put it back into the system for reuse.
Can you let our listeners know how they can find out more about you and the services you provide?
Yeah, you can go to recyclops.com, recyclops.com. And, you know, there's lots of information there. If you click on locations and select Wasatch or Summit counties, you'll find information specific to those areas.
Sounds great. We've been speaking with Ryan Smith. He's the founder and CEO of Recyclops. You've been listening to Mountain Money this morning, and we'd love to thank our sponsors, Jans Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
We also want to thank our guest, Bonnie Marcus, author of Not Done Yet, Dan Hemmert of GoEd, Ryan Smith of Recyclops. This is KPCW Park City.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.